Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 22nd, 2006. Our session today is entitled A U.S. Department of Peace. The presenter is John Marty. Let's listen in.
They can't. I'm John Marty. I'm not a member of U.S. Congress or anything. I'm a member of the State Senate in Minnesota. However, one who's very interested in the issue of peace, and titled this topic tonight, a U.S. Department of Peace, and it's supposed to be a look at approaches to the politics of war and peace in the United States. And the way I'd like to start is by pointing out, which I don't think is a shock to anybody here, how bad things really are. We had over 100 million people killed in the last century in wars around the world, many more than that. And we're well on our way to doing that again. This time, you count all the conflicts that have been going on. We don't do very well as a human race in terms of getting along with each other. Wars change. 200 and some years ago, we were thinking how idiotic the British were. They were the best military in the world. They lined up in nice rows, and our people hid behind rocks and shot at them. Now we have the biggest army in the world, and we have terrorists bombing us with little roadside bombs and keep picking off people. But terrorists, loose-knit terrorist armies, guerrilla forces, national governments, more and more forces now have weapons of mass destruction, we call them, whether chemical, biological, or nuclear. We don't know what the future holds, but the point is a handful of people with the right connections have the ability to destroy, conceivably, though we've never seen it, hundreds of thousands of lives. And we've had one response to this. Our Department of Defense, which was once upon a time more accurately called the Department of War, was there to fight wars and do that. And we've got the best of what's available in the world right now. We spend far more than after the Cold War, we spend far more than anybody else. We're far away number one in military, far away number one in military arms sales, which makes the problem worse too. We sell to India and Pakistan because it makes good money. And we wonder why they have such advanced weapons when they shoot against each other. Saddam Hussein was an ally of ours at one time. Lots of people would argue that we trained and equipped Osama bin Laden, not him personally, but the Taliban and so on. We wanted them on our side to cause trouble for the Soviet Union 20 years ago. And we train them, we equip them and everything else, and then they turn into no longer friends and we're in trouble. But our response, as I said, has been very single-mindedly prepare for war. In the past, it's always been defensive wars. This is the first time we've attacked preemptively for whatever reasons they gave, whatever reasons they were. The question is, are we making the world more safe by what we're doing, or are we actually making it more dangerous? I think you've probably all heard plenty of commentators who question this. If you remember 5 years ago, that's okay. It's nice to have a good attendance. I don't think I'm half Zoom leaves for choir, but you gotta say good stuff first.
Hurry.
Before we leave,
I'll give you the answer to you.
Oh, yeah.
But since September 11th, 2001, 5 years ago this fall, we've, I think, created more terrorists. The world was reaching out to us after September 11th. If you remember, we had sympathy from everywhere in the world. Countries that weren't really friendly to us were, boy, what can we do to help? We care about you. This is unfair. This is wrong. And we've spent billions of dollars in a war that has no end in sight. We've alienated most of the world. We've deeply strained our National Guard. The rest of our military, depending on who you talk to, says they're at the breaking point too, by taking people who were not ready to be deployed away from their families for over a year at a time. Are we at the breaking point or not? Who knows? But we certainly are straining our military, our National Guard. Again, it's hundreds of billions of dollars. And what's the result of those efforts? Not only the war has no end, we've turned the bulk of the world from being our friends to our enemies. We've got people who once respected us as a moral high ground country saying these guys don't even respect the Geneva Convention anymore, which we thought, I mean, even Soviet Union and other countries during the Cold War, even our worst enemies abided by the Geneva Convention, and here we use sophistry to say, well, these are enemy combatants instead of prisoners of war, so we can treat them differently. And we've, many people would argue, we're creating more terror. Everyone we kill, we create more terrorists, or it helps their recruiting people who have intense hatred for the United States. In Iraq, we've got a country that's just short of a civil war, with countless civilian casualties. Our government doesn't want to count them.
They do.
Our government doesn't want to count them because we're not sure what's going to happen. And Al-Qaeda, which we openly admit, did not have a presence in Iraq. They were not. Iraq was not part of Al-Qaeda. It's a good haven for Al-Qaeda people at this time. And the weapons of mass destruction, which we went to war for, have not yet been found. And it's oversimplification to say that the world loved us before then because they didn't, and they hate us now because they don't. But in generally, that's been the trend. We've created a lot more enemies, and most worrisome, we've created a lot of enemies from people who are intensely hating us. And feel we've killed their family, their friends. What do they have to lose by killing us? So if we're spending billions of dollars, straining all our resources on this, what's the alternative? Well, pacifism is not the purpose of this talk tonight. There are plenty of pacifists who believe war and violence is always wrong. Many Christians want to be pacifists, but aren't sure if it's a realistic alternative or not. A lot of us look at Dietrich Bonhoeffer and think of somebody who was deeply anti-war, who felt in the end he had to turn to extraordinary steps in the end. But I think there are very, very few American Christians, regardless of their political philosophy or anything, who would say that they don't at least agree with the just war theory. Since Augustine proposed it, the number one, the main requirement for just war is you've exhausted all alternatives, all nonviolent alternatives before you go to war. This session is not to make a case for or against pacifism, but to talk about alternatives and for those of us who believe that violence and war should be the last resort. Ron Sider, the theologian who created, who proposed, I'll suggest his book later, suggested the Christian peacemaker teams, Tom Fox, the guy who was killed in Iraq, and people talk about how, see, nonviolence doesn't work, he got killed. Ron Sider, the guy who proposed that, asked the question, how can Christians in the just war tradition claim that the violence that they justify is truly a last resort until they have invested billions of dollars and trained tens of thousands of people in a powerful, sustained testing of the possibilities of nonviolent alternatives? We're spending hundreds of billions of dollars in the war. If we're willing to devote those resources, wouldn't it be sensible first to try and devote hundreds of billions of dollars to preventing it? Many people are going to dismiss nonviolent alternatives as unsuccessful because of exactly the CPT case, the Tom Fox being killed. You got to be naive if you think that you go out there without a gun and you go out there and stand up there and the Soviet Union would not bulldoze over you, that Hitler, that Stalin, that you name it, Osama bin Laden wouldn't go and kill them. And nobody's pretending that that's what nonviolent action means. React peacefully doesn't mean that immediately they act peacefully towards us. Dealing with brutal regimes, brutal dictators, it's naive to think they're going to be nice to you. We have to remember one of the historical teachers of nonviolence, Mahatma Gandhi. There were tens of thousands of his people were killed. They were nonviolent. They did not return violence for violence, but they were killed. Does that mean it's a failure? Because people die, take great risks and die being nonviolent? Well, So war is a failure too, because we've lost thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands in war, and we don't consider it a failure because we lost people. It's part of the price of doing it, and frankly, nonviolent resistance is going to cause fatalities too. They all tend to be on one side, but I'd make the case that that doesn't mean it's a failure. William James in 1910 essay, The Moral Equivalent of War, wrote, "The war against war is going to be no holiday. Those seeking to prevent war must recognize that war draws out many noble traits in people." And he says, loyalty, self-sacrifice, courage, willingness to face death, discipline, dedication. He says that nonviolent alternatives cannot succeed with any less effort. And the point is, we're not going to prevent people involved in nonviolent action from dying. CPT folks, we met them in Israel a number of years ago, and they knew that they're putting their lives on the line, and people do die as a result of that. But that doesn't mean nonviolence doesn't work, but does it work? Well, we always hear about all the cases where military success works, but we never talk a lot about the nonviolent one. So I think people can think of one or two. Mahatma Gandhi, okay, that's the one I mentioned earlier. But there are many other examples. The 1986 overthrow of Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines, where the archbishop there, where the cardinal in Manila was getting on the radio telling people, stand up and go to the streets and protest. When people have got tanks and soldiers coming and attacking, stand in the streets and make it clear your views. Mahatma Gandhi's overthrow of the British Empire, Martin Luther King overturning segregation. Remember, they marched against dogs and fire hoses, and plenty of civil rights workers were killed. That doesn't mean it was a failure. Poland, the solidarity movement. South Africa, the end of apartheid. Every one of those is nonviolent. Tiananmen Square, the standing up to the tanks. That's the one case of the ones I'm listing that was a failure, that did not succeed at overthrowing the government. But they had the same standing up to the tanks outside the Duma in Moscow when the Soviet Empire was crumbling. And it was a give or take thing. I mean, soldiers and their people begging the soldiers, quit fighting, the government's falling, join us. And people without arms standing up to tanks. And they won. Again, all of the ones I mentioned, except the one in Tiananmen Square, worked. And Walter Wink wrote a beautiful book. I'll recommend this one too. It was in the bookstore a couple years ago. This copy I grabbed out of the library. But he talks about how, I'm just going to read two very short pages in here about some of the successful stories. He says, there have been some remarkable success stories of nonviolent struggle around the world recently. In the Philippines, a nonviolent revolution led by Corazon Aquino, with crucial support from churches, swept the dictator Ferdinand Marcos from office with a loss of only 121 lives. Think about if it had been a war, would there be less than tens of thousands of lives? Central to the effectiveness of that struggle was a background in training in nonviolent direct action provided by International Fellowship of Reconciliation. In Poland, solidarity irreversibly mobilized popular sentiment against the puppet communist regime. An entire clandestine culture, literature, spirituality came to birth there outside of authority of official society. This undercuts the oft-repeated claim that Mahatma Gandhi did in India or Martin Luther King did in the U.S. American South would never work under a brutal Soviet-sponsored government. Nonviolent general strikes have overthrown at least seven Latin American dictators. And he mentions several from 1931 to 1957. In 1989 and 90 alone, 14 nations underwent nonviolent revolutions, all of them successful except China. All were nonviolent except Romania. These revolutions involved 1.7 billion people. If we total all the nonviolent movements of the 20th century, the figure comes close to 3.4 billion people. And again, most were successful. And yet there are people who still insist nonviolence doesn't work. Gene Sharp has itemized 198 different types of nonviolent actions that are part of the historical record, yet our history books seldom mention any of them, so preoccupied are they with power, politics, and wars. I'd make the case that if war is the last resort, as Ron Sider says, that means you got to spend hundreds of billions of dollars. None of these were well-funded efforts. Every one of them was small efforts that overturned governments that you said could never be overthrown. It can work. It does work. Well, is it, when we talk about nonviolence, I think we also think of not pacifism only, but passivity. And despite the similarity in words, there's a big difference between them. Nonviolent action requires courageous confrontation. The unarmed people standing up in front of the tanks, they knew they were risking their lives. But throughout history, we've seen people who show courage doing this, and many would argue it takes more courage to go stand up to this without a weapon than it does with a weapon. And as Christians, we look at Jesus Christ and his ministry. He was absolutely clear, I think we realize, in his commitment to nonviolence, including when he faced violent enemies. But he didn't roll over and play dead either. He confronted injustice many times, very upfront and very in your face, overturning the money changers in the temple. And it's not like he picked a fight every time he could. He slipped away a number of times from his enemies. He talks about how they were after him and he just left. But no question, he was confrontational in fighting for justice, and nonviolence does not imply, as some people would have it be, as they would assume it would be, is nonviolence means you sit back and let it go. I want to read one other thing from Walter Wink on that, because it's on this very point. Most Christians desire nonviolence, yes, but they're not talking about nonviolent struggle for justice. They mean simply the absence of conflict. They like the system to change without having to be involved in changing it. What they mean by nonviolence is as far from Jesus' third way as a lazy nap in the sun is from a confrontation which protesters are being clubbed to the ground. When a church has not lived out a costly identification with the oppressed, offers to mediate between hostile parties, it merely adds to the total impression it wants to stay above the conflict and not take sides. The church says to the lion and the lamb, "Here, let me negotiate a truce," to which the lion replies, "Fine, after I finish my lunch." Anyway, I recommend that book. It's a
What's
short
the name of that book?
It's Jesus and Nonviolence, A Third Way by Walter Wink. And I'll return this to the library.
That's part of a series, by the way. That's the third part.
Okay. I did not know it was part of a series. I read it several years ago when I was here.
Challenging the powers is generally what the
series is about.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anybody's seen this in the bookstore. That's where I got it a few years ago, I think. Anyway, who is trying to do this? Well, there are a number of nonprofit groups. I mentioned Christian Peacemaker Teams. When we were in Israel-Palestine a number of years ago, we met with the CPT folks in Hebron, which is a very hot spot community. They would walk the Palestinian kids past the Jewish settlement to their school. One time they stopped throwing stones at the kids, they started throwing at the CPTers. But they've been very constant presence there, knowing when you sign up for it, you realize you're going to be putting your life on the line, but many times it does make a difference. There's a friend of mine in Minnesota who's been working with an international group called Nonviolent Peace Force. That's a very aggressive effort. They're in 47 different countries now. They are hiring professionally trained volunteer peacemakers who their one pilot project right now, they have, I don't know, 50 people or so in Sri Lanka. Things had been going relatively well, but in these struggles, there are ups and downs. And there was a scary attack a month ago in which somebody was clearly targeting one of the nonviolent peace force members. But these are all nonprofit, small, relatively speaking, small efforts. They're not in terms of the billions of dollars, let alone the hundreds of billions of dollars. And we've always had war colleges in this country. There's progress in that area, too. There's a St. Thomas University in Minnesota has a peace studies program. Lots of campuses around the country are getting peace and justice programs, nonviolence efforts that do research, that do studying, that do training. So there's some positive steps in that direction. They don't train nearly as many people as our military academies do, and there's nobody who pays you to be, with very, very few exceptions, nobody pays you to be a nonviolent person working to address conflict. And our society is, on the other hand, constantly teaching violence. The most visible way is through television and the media. Just constantly drives it into head, but it's political leaders too. But we want to be tough on them. I know before the 2004 election, Bush and Kerry seemed to be who could talk the toughest. It's not going to, we're going to capture Osama bin Laden. We're going to hunt him down and kill him. My state local party chair in Minnesota wrote a press release the week before the election saying, Osama bin Laden ought to be shaking in his boots tonight and so on. John Kerry is going to hunt him down and kill him. This is people talking. See how much we can sound like we're going to get those thugs. Talk tough. Media does that. Coleman McCarthy, the former Washington Post columnist, he was a pacifist and wrote many excellent columns. I read a column after 2001, September 11th, about how Washington Post needed him back because they laid him off because they didn't think he added enough to the selling of newspapers. Mm-hmm. But Coleman McCarthy, who's still active in peace work, wrote in 1999, the day after the Columbine shootings, Bill Clinton went to a high school in Alexandria, Virginia, gave a speech to the school's peer mediation club, which is, again, a nonviolent type of effort. Clinton said, quote, "We must teach our children to express their anger and resolve their conflicts with words, not weapons." McCarthy continues, "It was a great speech, but he went back that night and ordered up the most intense bombing of Belgrade since the war began 4 weeks before." What message does that send to children? You know, okay, hitting your enemy is not okay, but bombing their cities is okay? We've got a very uphill effort in this. And so why not try and move forward and try and come up with a new alternative? There's a resolution in Congress, a bill in Congress, to try and create a new U.S. Department of Peace, which is it's some sort of extremist effort they will portray it as. And they're not asking for the kind of funding the Department of Defense gets. I mean, I think truly if we're sincere about saying we believe in a just war theory, we believe that that's the last resort, you can't really pretend you're not doing that if you're not going to at least make a multi-billion dollar effort to do it. And I'd argue that the Department of Peace is more than it would involve State Department things, perhaps, because negotiation is... war is the failure of negotiation if we certainly beefed up efforts there, but it could also be the things that we once did much better than we do now, the Peace Corps, development assistance, and how our country is the bottom of the ranks of the Western developed nations in terms of how much we give. Those things are all part of a peace effort. And before opening it up for questions, I just want to again restate that I think Ron Sager hit the nail on the head. We cannot say that we are truly people who are willing to go to war only as a last resort. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in the middle of a war that's going on, turned to his response was a response that he thought he prayed over for a long time, he agonized over. But he was in the midst of a war and trying to make a painful decision to do it. But we can't say that we're in the same position here where every year we just appropriate more money and we have people who weren't willing themselves to go to war kind of proving that they're tough by sending other people to war. And that's not new in our country. That's as long as our country's history's been. But I happen to be one of those who thinks that if we, even though it would start out being something more symbolic than anything else, I think once you had institutionalized Department of Peace, even if it wasn't well funded, it would start giving people, you'd have somebody there advocating for a role that we don't have. And I'm convinced we do have an alternative, we just need the vision and we just need the will to do so. And with that, I think I wrapped it up in less than half an hour. Let's open it up for discussion. So those who have to leave can at least hear what I had to prepare. So anybody want to start?
I think there's one area in which prompt military action is desirable, and that is when one country suddenly invades another. Now, examples of this, I think, are the German attacks on all their neighbors in the Second World War. I think that we were quite justified in also the Japanese invasion of Southeast Asia. We were quite justified here. Another one is the attack of the South Vietnam, the North Vietnamese of the South. We were quite justified in going in there to defend one country against another. My favorite is the first Bush reaction to the invasion of Iraq and Kuwait, where he 100 hours back to military fighting, preserved the independence of Kuwait. But these are things where I think we need the ability to go in militarily, and we have to do it very promptly, almost instantaneously. And I don't see this as the
time factor.
There's no time for negotiation, yes.
Well, following that logic, I mean, the rest of the world should be invading the United States right now.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I won't argue with that.
Right. he's saying, look, if somebody's not invading somebody else, shouldn't start a war. I might quibble with you on the fact that there might be times when there's no time to do otherwise, but I do question whether intense pressure might be an acceptable alternative to some of them. I do think that you can justify most wars that way without really putting in a serious effort to prevent it or try to undo the harm. But anyway, I think you're saying here's one area where you would set aside is it's justified. And I think some people might argue there are other cases too outside of an invasion, maybe in Rwanda where nobody's invading anyone, but somebody's killing off their own people. But anyway, more discussion, your comments on that.
One thing I wanted to bring up is the huge degree to which the U.S. economy depends on war. Even leaving out all kinds of peripheral things, the defense industry is such a huge part of our economy that some people say, I buy into the idea that the U.S. will never be a more peaceful country until we're making our money in more peaceful ways.
I think it's
good in our best interest economically to fight wars all around the world because that's how so much of our country makes its money.
There have been many times the U.S. Congress appropriates money for new weapon systems because certain people have military industrial plants in their district and they want this done, so people in Congress appropriate money for weapons the Defense Department doesn't even want.
Exactly.
But and related to that, I think you can make the point of the of military sales to other countries to make money. You cannot sell military equipment to another country without the U.S. government's approval, and I feel pretty strongly our current president's done outrageous things towards war. But one thing that got, I noticed one mention about this big in the papers probably 6-7 years ago when Bill Clinton reauthorized military arms sales to South America. It had been, I don't know how long I had been following it closely, I don't know how long it had been banned, but we were not selling weapons to anybody in South America, and he signed a little document saying we're now going to allow they need permission on each sale, but once we start selling weapons there, we arm both sides in every conflict, and then we got to get involved to help out and they've got more high-powered stuff because we sold it to them.
Yeah.
But I think it's a good point. Other comments on that?
One of the things I have a friend who's a retired missionary that spent a lot of his years in Indonesia and still has a lot of contacts in Indonesia through the church. And the popularity of this country in Indonesia because of our invasion of Iraq was right in the tank. And the one thing that brought that popularity rating up very high was our support of that country after they suffered the tsunami and the dollars we put in to help them recover from that. It was like they forgot we invaded Iraq. A peaceful effort does pay off, of caring about people.
You know, waging peace instead of waging war.
Yeah, on that issue, on that point, which I think I have a feeling most people here would agree with you on that, it was interesting that a lot of the folks we think are most anti-U.S., often some of the Islamic fundamentalists, one of the ways they recruit is very effectively is in poor communities in Pakistan, Afghanistan. They're the ones who operate the schools. They're the ones who operate the human service stuff because nobody else does. And, you know, if somebody's taking care of you, you might think what they're teaching is a good thing. But we'd be wise to not criticize them for doing that, but to do it ourselves. Yeah. Other comments that can move a different direction or on these points? Yes?
Yeah, I have a concern that what we have started out as a political conflict has now escalated into Christianity against Muslims.
Mm.
That really worries me.
And to piggyback on that, someone I know pointed out to me that the early growth of Christianity was fueled in a huge way by martyrdom and by killing thousands and thousands of Muslims. We're only fueling the most, you know, the most extreme right-wing fundamentalist Islam hatred of the United States. Martyrdom fuels religious fervor in a big way.
And again, the way it doesn't only have, I mean, I think if this becomes a world war we're in the middle of, and any world war could be the last war on the planet, but it's probably a religious thing that could fuel that. But the other part of that is that in doing that and creating all the enemies of a different religion, of a different ethnic groups and so on, is when we're trying to put pressure on Iran not to do some things that we're very scared of, we lose all our allies in the region. People who might be willing to join us in fighting against them kind of think, well, why should they? They don't trust us. Why is Iran any worse than we are?
One of the things I did with my confirmation classes last year was we put together a tour in the Twin Cities, visit a variety of religious communities, and the most valuable one we visited was a Saturday morning youth program at the Minnesota Islamic Center. And what they did was invited our confirmation class in to help us both understand their faith as well as observe their morning prayer practice. Hmm. And our kids, all they heard was the worst of the Islamic faith. They actually made some friends there that day.
Who initiated? You did, or?
We have a group of pastors in our community that are doing that every 2 years, and we visited Temple Israel, Minnesota Islamic Center. Next time we're going to do a Hindu and a Buddhist temple.
You know, that's the way you build understanding. It was interesting that, I think it was Notre Dame had hired an Islamic professor to teach there, and State Department banned him from entering the country as a terrorist risk. This guy hired by Notre Dame, and they turned him away. And I was going to say, what kind of this guy? If we're as afraid of Muslim extremists as we should be about Christian extremists here, which I think we should be concerned about, the first thing we want to do is encourage moderate Muslims to be out and be visible and be supported, but certain names and other things, I don't really know the exact reasons, but there were a number of columns written about how outrageous it was.
I think that I would regard Muslims as being allies rather than enemies of Christians. We all believe in the same God. We believe in a good God and a powerful God. Now, I think the big division, both here and in Far Eastern countries, is between those who really believe in the tenets of their religion and those who can dismiss it.
Or those who use their religion for a political agenda.
Yeah, but as I see it, Christians and Jews and Muslims all believe basically in the same God and in a generally a good and powerful God. I think this separates us from those who don't believe in God or feel he's unimportant. But instead, because there are these Muslim fanatics out there, we seem to have the feeling that we are opposed to Islam. And I think that is a mistaken identification of what the really sincere people in Islam are like.
One point, and I got a question for people in other states, but there was a, since the Iraq War began, I guess it's already 3 or 4 years now, but there was a general, I'm not sure, Army, Marine Corps general, who was quoted a number of times, wearing uniform, giving speeches about how God put us in this place for a reason. Our God is more powerful than their God. Very open of the point you were making about a big war between faiths. Very openly saying stuff like that. And the White House said they were not backing up what he was saying. They were sort of gently challenging it, but they didn't put the guy down. They, in fact, pointed him to a new position. And I think that's where you get the fear. We're preaching the same hate that we're complaining that they're preaching. But I'm curious if people in other states, we have this Islamic center in Minnesota, and I heard a few people going there. I never knew of youth groups from greater Minnesota coming in and going there. Do any other states, the people here, you familiar with any sort of Islamic center and so on, that does outreach kind of thing, or either education of Islamic schools or outreach to the community, if other people had contacts?
This spring, the Folklife Festival in Seattle, each year they center on a certain culture, and they did the Arab culture. And so they were teaching thousands of people about it. And there was a whole kids center where kids were learning to write their names in the Arabic script, making class.
How about others?
There's an Islamic center in Milwaukee, but I really don't know enough about it to say, but I have a sense that it's open to people visiting and helping to create good relations.
Right after September 11th, I know in Minnesota there were a lot of interfaith efforts and especially outreach. That was one of the positive things that happened right afterwards, mm-hmm. where a lot of people... the existing mainline congregations and so on were joining up, were intentionally reaching out to the Islamic Center and having joint rallies and things like that. We have a Minnesota group that lobbies the state capitol, Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, which was Protestant Catholic, then Protestant Catholic Jew, and now it's Protestant Catholic Jew and Muslim. So it's there have been progress in some small ways in this way, but in creating understanding, at least among the American people, if not.
That's an amazing sight when they meet, to be under the dome and to have one of the leaders of the religious community in Minnesota, whether it's Muslim or Christian or whoever, lead in prayer and have all of these faiths under there in prayer. It's talk about peace building, that's where it happens.
This is an American, because I'm actually from Australia. But I did a subject called Study of Religion, and within that we learn about the different Hindu, Buddhist, etc. And I really agree, because we went and traveled to some different places and different centers, which I know, we have a fair few Buddhist places, it's pretty prevalent with the Asian community, and not just Asian community, but... So I know that they have some outreach programs, but it really is true, when you go actually visit them and just sort of see it with your own eyes, it's completely different perspective. And you just gain a new understanding, like, completely in terms of peacefully and just seeing that they're the same people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's really...
When you don't have a conflict and you reach out to people, it's the perfect time to learn. Again, when I mentioned earlier Hebron in Israel, there is a temple there. One side it's a mosque, one side it's a temple. The one side they're religious ancestors of both faiths who are buried there, and you can get in. One door is the door the Muslim folks go in, the other door is the one the Jews go in, and each of them have Israeli guards at both entrances, not Palestinian guards, but take out one of them, the men have to have their heads covered, the other one, the women have to have their heads covered. So they're trying to think, which one is this one? But that was, you'd hope that would be a kind of place where you build understanding, but that was a place that an Israeli doctor 10, 12, 13 years ago went in there during a call to prayer time and killed about 10, 20 people or so on. And when you get the hatred already there, it's kind of hard to break it down. And one of the CPT people said, he was talking about there's a Holocaust museum in Hebron and in the basement of a synagogue, and he went in there, and he had some relative who had been killed in the Holocaust, and people, the first time he went in there, they, here's this new guy in here, he's a tourist, who knows what, and a few months later he went back there again, and by then he knew he was a CPT, and soldiers were saying, well, you get out of here, kind of thing. You're working with those Palestinian folks, and this is for us, and so on. It was a hateful kind of thing in a place that should be bringing peace. Yes?
Our family's been involved in AFS. We have foreign exchange students live with us, and I think that's such a powerful way to build understanding. And I haven't been following it closely, but I wonder if anybody knows after September 11th if the visitations between Islamic countries and the U.S., both in sending American students over there and having them come here, have those been cut? Because if they have, that's really lost opportunities for building peace.
We have a lot of AFS programs and Rotary and other things in Minnesota, but very few of them. I don't know of any who had Islamic or Arab country students coming here. Is anybody...
I worked with University Admissions for a couple of years right after September 11th, and there was a huge difference in students who were admitted to the United States.
I've heard that from
right.
The university level.
Exactly, yeah, and it was really, really distressing.
So it was very hard for you to do the recruiting because it couldn't get...
Right, yeah, and just new rules about all these things that people had to prove in terms of citizenship and everything. Really over the top.
Well, there used to be, I mean, at Babel, there used to be a huge Arab community, and now it's gone.
One of the organizations that I became familiar with that's really a wonderful organization doing increased people's understanding of the world is the Foreign Policy Institute in this country. And there's local expressions of it. Minnesota's expression is the Minnesota International Center. What that one does is invites middle-level leadership from around the world to come to Minnesota to meet the community. We hosted 12 middle-level leaders from Africa last year in our homes and had them visit the community. And there were Islamic people from those countries in that delegation, and it's a great way to get to know personally people who are different from you.
Yes. I often speak with groups when they have International Center folks come over. They want to speak with somebody in the government or several people there, or else State Department does it too. And it's always interesting when State Department comes in there. They have all these simultaneous translators, very impressive people, and keep thinking the message you talk to with a lot of people, a lot of countries, about is one who doesn't support our foreign policies on a lot of issues. I keep wondering if these translators, if they're just pure and simple translators, but there's always a host for the people there too from the State Department. You wonder what kind of messages they get back, but I don't know that they that they're censoring or anything. They keep coming back and asking me to speak to them. But, we had this guy from Burkina Faso in our home overnight, and that's in West Africa. It's a little tiny country. He'd spent most of his diplomatic career in Paris for his country. And the best foreign relations thing that I did was a good bottle of wine and some bread. And we stayed up all night. You learn a lot there. Elsa?
To move it back to a Department of Peace, I'm wondering what kinds of things would we envision the department actually doing? Where would the money be going to? What kinds of programs would we be supporting?
Well, Dennis Kucinich, the House member from Ohio, who ran for president a couple of years ago, and I can't think of who. Mark Dayton was one of our senators, was one of the co-authors. I'm not sure who the author was, but their proposal is relatively modest in terms of funding and so on. But I think most of it is they're pushing for the concept right now because they don't have the votes to do it. But I think the envisioning, the people I've been working with on it. What can we do at the state level? They ask us to sign letters, petitions to Congress to do it. Does that do any good? Well, better than not doing it. It's small steps. But I think they do envision it as being the types of things, both in terms of how we can reach out to development assistance, plus to having more exchange efforts. I guess I'd say we shouldn't be trying to limit what it can do, because anything nonviolent that builds understanding is a good, or reduces tension is a good thing. But has anybody else been working on any of those efforts? Because there is a national effort now to create a U.S. Department of Peace. Has anybody here been involved in that in any way? Because I got involved about a year or two ago, and it didn't. There wasn't much they could do other than we asked our local members of Congress to sign on as co-authors of it. But
is the press covering that?
The press is not given much attention to it, which is why some people who have been working on Minnesota have written letters to the editor, occasionally writing commentaries, which is often the way you try and raise public awareness of it when the media isn't interested. And I think if you had a member of Congress who's pushing it and willing to be very vocal on it, which again, the authors in their states, I presume they are pressing it and getting a little more attention to it. But a state like Minnesota, where they're not the actual authors but a co-sponsor of the proposal, is the kind of thing that they don't write about it. It's not their high priority. It's kind of, oh, there's only a small group of people interested in it.
But C-SPAN covers a lot. If you have a meeting in Washington that you could let them know, they cover a lot.
Right. I have not been, I've been involved in the point of coming to a couple of meetings and agreeing to help facilitate a meeting and writing some letters and things like that, but I have not been more involved in it than that.
Yeah.
But you're right. The main thing, it's not the kind of issue that people are going to say, oh, we're going to vote for a presidential candidate based on whether they support a Department of Peace or not.
Right.
I think it's also a concept that, what's the opposition to it? It's the opposition is, we don't understand what this is, you know, you've got to be, you don't care, you're a naive fool if you think that we can go up against them with stand up to their tanks and so on. But I think that's why we need to do the education.
Talking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wouldn't the resistance to it just simply be that they stand to lose something economically if they have, like you say, such a huge vested interest in keeping this economy, a military-based economy? You might provide alternatives to resolving things without
military. I don't think the military-industrial complex that Dwight Eisenhower warned us about couldn't have been more right on about the dangers of it. I don't know that they've taken this as a, we got to oppose this, because I don't think they even see it as close enough to being a threat to their stuff yet. I think that the reality is if you had something, even if it is a small, underfunded agency, you've at least got a voice in the cabinet who's saying, maybe at least somebody thinks about it every time the decisions are made. Have we tried alternatives?
Yeah. And who would they appoint as the head?
Yeah. This administration.
Yeah. And Lisa Rice.
Yeah. Those pictures of Donald Rumsfeld with Saddam Hussein back in the 80s, shaking hands with him and meeting with him. At the time, he was doing the stuff we now say, well, we had to get rid of him because he was gassing the Kurds and using weapons of mass destruction, banned weapons. He was using them at the time we were supporting it. We weren't supporting his doing that, but we were intentionally looking the other way because we wanted them as an ally against Iran. And so I'm sure the Donald Rumsfelds of the world are the types they need.
One problem I foresee is how you split responsibilities between the new Department of Peace and existing organization.
There's
too many things where I think it's going to be difficult to split out functions, and all the bureaucrats in the old departments are going to fight transferring anything out of their regimes.
Even if the Department of Peace was a small agency, and like I said earlier, you could move things like foreign development assistance and so on into that, because it obviously relates. You don't have to do that. You just need somebody who's a spokesperson, who's an advocate for those things, saying before,
right,
how much of our aid is military, how much of it's development assistance. I keep thinking when Kennedy started the Peace Corps in the early 60s, it was idealistic young Americans who were going out and trying to help the world, and was very well received, partly because after World War II, where I think we were seen as people who sacrificed a lot to help the rest of the world, and then after the war, when we're a broke nation, we invest billions of dollars in today's money in the Marshall Plan to rebuild the countries our enemies were in. The world saw us as the good guys, and I don't care if it's all in the Department of Peace or not, but you need somebody to say, somebody in the White House to be saying, we need to do this, and before we talk about war, let's talk about the alternatives. Any other aspect? It doesn't have to stay on Department of Peace, but that was the title to try and bring it, because
well,
I think it is a solution.
I have more or less a question, not so much a comment, about a Department of Peace, of setting up something like that, how much respect they're going to get out of, even if it is a small agency, how much respect within the existing government structure that's there, how much they would get versus, trying to build more of a grassroots campaign through existing departments that people already maybe respect more or less than something that, like, I would almost see, if we, as much as I like the idea, showing a Department of Defense might almost also show a weakness, or a Department of Peace, excuse me, might also show a weakness in saying, now, since we've done all this damage, now we have to, in the background, create this department to kind of pick up for our slack. So I just
want to get I'm curious, but I was going to say, in terms of your concern, the reaction from the rest of the world?
Well, the rest of the world, as well as people who are fueling the fire in this war in Iraq.
Because the rest of the world can't be feeling any worse if we create a Department of Peace. I think they would appreciate it, but I understand your point. I'm curious if anybody else has comment on that. Because I think you can have people in the current departments. I mean, we have, I'm familiar with state agencies more than federal government agencies, but they all have their turf and they're all out to protect it, but they're going to be out to protect it if you put an office of whatever, office of peace or negotiation or friend building or ally building in the Department of Defense. Others are going to say, well, ours, we deserve the money. We're the ones who do the real work. There's still going to be that attitude wherever it is. I think you need somebody, you need an entity in government to be fighting for it. And, I mean, I do everything I can to encourage people with some of these nonprofit efforts, the CPT and so on. But
Jimmy Carter would be a good first person.
Jimmy Carter would be a good first
yes.
Secretary of Peace.
How do you see Voice of America fit into this? Do they promote peace and understanding, or are they just a total propaganda?
I'm not sure that I would guess that Radio Free Europe in the past, in Cold War days, and Voice of America, I kind of doubt that they, I don't hear the broadcast, maybe somebody else here knows more about it, but I can't picture it being highly respected these days. I don't know that it's going to take people who don't know, who aren't supportive of us and say, oh, wow, these guys are pretty good after all. I don't have confidence that our media, our government-sponsored media has any better.
Right.
Other comments, any other direction, anything else?
I have one observation, which is that Art, and I'm speaking to you behind the whiteboard. I wonder sometimes we named the Department of Defense the Department of Defense, but it used to be called the Department of War. And I think to some extent that may have been a rhetorical act to sort of make that a more palatable department, and perhaps this Department of Peace is an attempt to cast the Department of Defense back as its department, as the Department of War, and would it be as effective or fruitful to launch a campaign to rename the Department of Defense what it actually is the Department of War?
Mark, you may not have been here when I served, but I did mention the other, that was the previous name, and I think it's a more accurate name. At least until this war, we could argue that it was defense-oriented, it was responding to attacks and so on. But yeah, now it is a Department of War, and it is semantics that for a purpose. I mean, I think it was changed to Department of Defense for exactly the reason you mentioned. And I don't know that I want to be saying we ought to change the name back. I think it would be more honest, but it sounds like you're trying to promote the war too. But.
Well, it also seems like that if you name it the Department of Defense, then it gives it a reason for existing all the time, rather than just when we're at war.
Right. Right.
But I mean, I think it's going to exist all the time.
Well, of course.
It would be nice if we could downsize it some.
Yeah, well, why don't we call it the Department of Peace while we're at peace?
That's
hopefully we can hammer it out. Well, let's get there.
If we ever get there, that would be change the name of the
goal. Now, aren't some of those think tanks doing some of this peace stuff, though?
There are plenty of groups, I mean, Carnegie Endowment for Peace, there are plenty of groups out there trying to do it. My only point is that we shouldn't put those down in the least. We should be doing whatever we can to help with them, but it would certainly be nice. I mean, the UN was created for this purpose, but the UN has been bashed so much in our country, and it's got plenty of problems. That I think we need a voice for this in the United States government.
I agree.
Because again, in terms of arms sales and in terms of military budget, Soviet Union was always not far behind us, and now there's nobody even close. I mean, I don't know what we are, three times what China is, four times, whatever the second highest is in the world, but we're way above everybody else now. So,
is China funding our defense budget?
So to speak, from borrowed money. So,
who knows?
So, yes. Anyway, we're about out of time. I appreciate the discussion. We can stay around for a few minutes more if anybody wants to talk yet until Vespers. But I do think that this is an area that there's not a lot of vocal activism in the U.S. from the vast majority of people. There's a very large anti-war peace movement, but in terms of a large percentage of the population, 30, 40, 50%, they're not and never have been active in something like this, but I do think there would be broad support for this if you could get it to the public attention. So anyway, I appreciate your attention on this and hope it stimulates some discussions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.